Now, when did we start talking about a house as an investment instead of just somewhere to live? Oxford University geographer Danny Dorling, who started his career looking at negative equity in the 1990s, thinks it only really goes back for a couple of decades. His new book, All That Is Solid, The Great Housing Disaster, challenges many of our assumptions about property. That houses are always a good investment, that they can resolve our shortfall in pensions, income and job security. Most controversially, he counters the widely held belief that we just need to build a lot more of them to solve the shortage. Dorling's speciality is demography, the study of human populations. When I spoke to him earlier, I asked him what that particular discipline had to tell us about the way we live now.
Well, if you look at housing from a demographic approach, it's a very nuts and bolts approach. You're looking at how many families there are, how big they are, how much the population has been growing, and you then look at housing from the point of view of stock, and you count up how many homes there are, how many flats, and then how many bedrooms there are. And then you get a shock because you suddenly find there are far, far more bedrooms than people. And in fact, the ratio of people to rooms in this country has been rising rapidly. And then you think, well, why on earth do we have a housing crisis?
So how did we get to that situation?
If you take the long view of it, we can go back as far as 1911. And we had quite a high degree of inequality in housing then. It actually rose in 1921. But from 1921 all the way through to 1981, we began to fit better into our housing. It wasn't just that we built more, but we fitted into what we had better and better each decade. And then from 1981 onwards, the inequalities began to grow in housing. And so they've reached a peak in the 1911 census, shows this incredible inequity. And underlying the problems are inequalities in income. As poorer people become poorer and richer people become richer, the ability of different groups in society to buy housing alters. So people at the top of society can afford bigger homes, more homes, sometimes two or three homes. People at the bottom of society can't afford the rent, even on very pokey flats.
Now, your big assertion in the book is that building more houses, per se, is not a solution. Can you explain that?
My big worry is that we'll build houses and then we'll discover that this doesn't get rid of our housing problem because people are unable to afford the housing. So if we do build more houses, more of what is built will be bought for buy-to-let, letting. Landlords will buy even more. Landlords have bought an enormous amount of property in the last 5 years. They've increased their wealth in housing by $245 billion in just the last 5 years. And in many cases, housing is more efficiently used by a family if they buy it and stay in it for 20, 25, 30 years than it is used by people constantly moving between it because they're on short-term lets. And the other problem with building more housing is that more people who can afford second homes will end up getting second homes. And as the top of society, particularly the 1%, get richer and richer and richer, it becomes normal to have a flat in London, a house in Surrey, and maybe another house somewhere else. And that's another way in which we're using housing less efficiently.
In terms of the kinds of housing that's being built as well, what's your concern? Because there are an awful lot of one- and two-bedroom flats one sees going up in a lot of city centres.
Yes, I mean, a lot of these flats were built partly because of the explosion in the student population. People thought they could make money out of these. But students don't stay students forever. They try to form families and they try to have kids. And this kind of housing doesn't work for families. The number of households with children who are renting privately has shot up recently. So it's, I think, almost one in four households with kids in England is living in a house where they have a landlord and they have a tenancy that really only guarantees them, you know, 2 months.
Now, the right to buy that the Conservative government brought in at the beginning of the 1980s, this is a defining moment in the British attitude to housing. How do you think it changed us?
Well, the right to buy also coincided with the creation of the current form of housing benefit we have. So the huge housing benefit bill we now have partly coincides with that. I mean, what happened to right to buy is people who've been in their council house for some time were able to buy it at a discount. When they sold it on, often they didn't sell it to somebody else who'd lived there, but to somebody else who'd become a landlord. And so it in effect privatised renting. There wasn't a reciprocal right to sell. That was the real problem with the right to buy. The right to buy does increase people's freedoms. I think it was a good right. But you also need the right, if you're in a house and you're having trouble paying a mortgage, to be able to become a tenant of, say, a housing association, and for you to stay in that home and for your children to keep going to the school they're going to. And if we only had the right to sell at the same time as the right to buy, we could have blurred the mix between owning occupation and renting, and we wouldn't have stored up the huge problem that we have now in that we have such a small social rented sector and so many people trying to make money out of other people by renting them homes that often it would make sense for them to own because they intend to live there for a long time.
Well, let's talk about the operation of markets, because you're very critical of the way you think they operate. But many people would say, you know, it's an essential freedom. And indeed, that it would include the freedom to regard property as an investment, whether for a pension, for your children.
Yes.
What's your view?
Well, we've had markets for 5,000 years. I mean, markets are very efficient things. Markets work best when people are in a similar position in the market. So when you have a society where people have similar income, markets are incredibly efficient. When you have very wide income inequalities, markets are very inefficient because people without much income simply can't take part in the market. And people with very high income can buy things they don't really need, but you know they're trying to think about what to do with their money. The other problem with markets in housing, apart from the fact that our income has become so unequal, is there's only a fixed amount of land. So whereas if you take something like gold, if the rich decide they want to buy lots and lots of gold, it really doesn't badly affect the rest of us. Or if they want to buy lots of paintings, it's the same. But if the rich buy an increasing proportion of property, say, in the centre of London, that pushes everybody out of the centre, which then pushes the people who are on the edge of the centre further away. It pushes other people further away. It increases commuting. That the problem with a free market in a very unequal society for housing is we end up really inefficiently using the land.
But then if you look at something like the gentrification that went on, say, in Islington in North London starting in the 60s, wasn't that proof of a free market improving a neighbourhood where actually local authorities often failed miserably?
It was almost the opposite. I mean, Islington's famous for the demonstrations that took place to try to stop the housing there being demolished because it was almost slum housing. I mean, it's a lovely story is what happened in Islington. But it wasn't the market. It was actually people demonstrating to prevent the demolition of homes that they wanted to keep, homes which are now worth fortunes. The problem now in Islington is that you have far fewer children being housed there because families with children can't afford to live there, so you're often having fairly affluent couples living in a home with, say, four bedrooms.
But there was definitely a factor in the 1960s and 70s, which many middle-class people still feel strongly about. There was an attitude among some local authorities to demolish period properties against the wishes of people, including social tenants, but also including, buyers.
Yes.
And this idea that there was a kind of one-size-fits-all mass-built property. Hasn't that left a legacy of mistrust? Isn't that part of why people are buying property the way they are or regard it the way they do?
Well, the idea of buying property as investment really is something for the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, in the 1960s, we did terrible things like putting urban motorways through and demolishing neighbourhoods and so on. And I'm not saying the state would do a brilliant job of replacing the private market. What we need is a far better mixed system, which is part of, say, what the right to sell would give you, because you'd end up with council housing being pepper-potted in streets which are otherwise owner-occupied. And one part of our housing problem is that a large determinant of price is what they call location, 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 which often boils down to how far away is this house from a poor estate. Now, if you don't know whether your neighbours are going to become council tenants, that premium on the price of housing for the area, which is largely based on snobbery and fear, would begin to reduce. But I'm not against having a housing market. Housing markets work very well in large parts of the world, and they worked well in Britain before. It's trying to operate a housing market with a tiny social rented sector at a time of high and widening income inequality. For instance, people often say we should just let people build and that would sort it out. Given people's current wealth and income, if you let people build, you'd have shanty towns built around the edge of London because that's all people could actually afford to pay for.
Interesting. There is an argument that says your argument assumes everyone might be aspiring and responsible. And I can think of an example of, you know, a modern middle-class housing estate built on a very large section of land, a relatively small section of social housing. And I remember going to visit and, you know, someone pointing out that's where the social housing is. It's really obvious because there's a lot of antisocial behaviour around it. And there is, again, is it not a British phenomenon that people feel there are those who don't want to take responsibility for their housing, and only a free market enables people to choose how to live and to take responsibility for themselves?
It's certainly a very British attitude, but you've only got to go to other parts of Europe to see that you can have mixed housing within the same, you know, set of apartment blocks in a city. And we really don't divide into a feckless set of poor people and the highly responsible set of rich people. And in fact, some of the most irresponsible behaviour is by some of the richest. If you look at people digging down in their Kensington mansion and their neighbours' houses falling in on them. I mean, no council tenant does that. It's only the super rich who can really upset their neighbours. But one problem is that we did segregate our housing. When we built the council estates, we built them as estates. When we now build small council estates in mixed developments, the council parts is often the bit that blocks out the noise from the road. So it creates a stigma and a difference to begin with. And then fear builds on that. And the fear in Britain that people have of other people is palpable. And it's partly because our wealth differences have got so large. If you take children in Britain and the amount of money they're likely to inherit, say, the poorest tenth of children in Britain are likely to inherit 100 times less wealth than the richest tenth. And this is a parallel life, you know, kind of country to live in. The real parallel divides in Britain are between the very wealthy and the very poor. And it's not easy to have a mixed society and one where people are happy with each other when you have underlying it these huge income and wealth differences.
But the way you talk about, you know, having a more mixed neighbourhood environment, ultimately, isn't that social engineering you're talking about to make it happen?
Well, we've socially engineered to not get it. We are an extremely segregated country, and we're partly an extremely segregated country because of the rules and laws that we chose to have. If you, say, look at Japan, and you look at a Japanese city, and you ask somebody in Japan, why do you live in a particular part of the city? It's often because they chose there because it was a particularly nice park or somewhere else near it. But the variation in house prices is much, much lower. And you have a house next to blocks of flats, next to a small house, next to a larger house. And I would say that's a more normal situation. And you have to engage in quite a lot of engineering to get to the situation we have where streets are so very, very different. You have to have rules. For instance, we have rules in London where one of Tony Blair's children, I think, wanted to let out his basement and wasn't allowed to because the very large house he was in had to be kept its character. And that's social engineering to keep up social divisions.
You talk in the book about Europe where renting is much more common, but I've been struck by the fact that, say, Germany, the government there certainly in recent years has been encouraging people to buy rather than rent. And I wonder if Britain really is that different anymore.
Well, in Germany and certainly in Switzerland, you're looking at up to in areas half the population renting. Renting makes a huge amount of sense when you are mobile. So for young adults, particularly students, but also young professionals, it makes a lot of sense to rent because if you're not going to be in somewhere for very long, you're unlikely to want to look after the property that much. And also later on in life, we're very bad at realising how our health deteriorates and how we're likely to want to go from one kind of housing to another as our hips go and our joints go. So renting makes a lot of sense at the start and end of life. But in the middle, particularly for families, particularly with children, when they want to keep their friends, say, from between the ages of 4 and 18, you really want to stay in one place. And the best way to do that is to buy. And also, some people like doing DIY. And it makes sense to own a house when you like to do it up yourself. It doesn't make sense. It's less efficient when you're not particularly good at DIY to do it. And we really should be trying to move towards a situation where the choice between renting and owning is a choice between do you want to look after the property yourself or not, not about is this pile of bricks and mortar going to make you some fortune for your old age, because it can't make us all a fortune for our old age. That just isn't mathematically possible.
I mean, in terms of what houses are for then, is that your fundamental concern, is what we now invest in the idea of a house?
Yes, there's a terrible way in which for a small group in society, and this really is only about 10% are going to make a lot of money out of housing, housing has become their security for the future, and that works to the disbenefit of many other people. For instance, people often talk about landlords, and they forget landlords are only 2% of the population. So the idea that this is a large group who are funding their private pensions through being a landlord is just 2%. And for that 2% to be able to build up the wealth that they are building up, a much higher number of families have to be paying them rent at inflated rents for it to be possible. And we're moving towards a society again. We have a large number of people with absolutely no housing wealth and no great stake in housing, and a small number of people who don't have to do very much but are slowly getting richer and richer because of the housing precarity of the majority of the population.
In brief, how would you sum up the key changes that you think we need, and how likely do you think it is there's a political will to implement them?
I've listed 10 possible changes in the book, but to be honest, only one or two of them I think have to happen to begin things moving in the right way. And even if none
Which
of them...
are?
Well, things like improved rights for tenants, but also reduced tax subsidies for landlords, because the incentive to buy another property with cash is just too high. However, if none of these things happen, we're likely just to see the bubble get bigger and bigger, and like all bubbles, it will crash, and then we'll have to do something about it. When it comes to political will, the thing that makes me most optimistic is there's a quote from Grant Shapps when he was the housing minister. And this was only 2 years ago, when Grant Shapps said house prices should be going up by less than incomes. Now, if Grant actually believed that, and we know that incomes have been falling, if you've got members of the current government who actually do believe that this is out of kilter as much as everybody else believes it's out of kilter, there's room for optimism. Their huge, huge political problem is it's so hard to suggest something you're going to do about it, because so many people think that their house is going to give them a fortune in future and cannot work out that this fortune cannot arise because there are not enough people with the money to give them all the money they think they're going to make.
Danny Dorling. All That Is Solid, The Great Housing Disaster, is published by Alan Lane. That's all for today.